native to Guba Sea, as far as we were able to tell, back in the days when we had the means to study it, when some of the original crew survived, alongside the first generations who we managed to train up to some extent. Anaerobic, though, Harris said. The life here, every scrap of it we've seen so far. That is, it doesn't exploit oxygen. Correct, Susan said. That's what we worked out. You understand the thick air of this world is choked with carbon dioxide. That alone would contribute about 5 times as much pressure as all of Earth's atmosphere. A product of all the volcanism, no doubt. It traps a lot of heat, making the planet warmer than it has any right to be so far from the star. And the carbon dioxide in the air is what the life here feeds off. There's some kind of metabolic chain that exploits sunlight to cause carbon dioxide to react with other gases and minerals to liberate hydrogen. And it's the recombination of hydrogen that seems to power the larger and more complex plant growths and animal life. Hydrogen plays the role that oxygen does on our worlds. Well, again, we thought so. We were never able to survey properly. This world is so large, you see, that its continents have remained largely islands, cut off from each other, and entirely different evolutionary strategies seem to have been tried out, as if there were several planets compressed into one. The ghosts keep the fauna away. We never got a close look. But anyhow, it will soon make no difference. The island crew listened to this, electrified. Jophiel said, "You're talking about the upcoming Nova event." "Indeed." Harris nodded. "I've done more work on that with Asher. That star is becoming more unstable every time we look at it. It will climax in a violent event soon, maybe only months away. It'll be something like a Nova, yes. And this world will be battered." Nicola grunted. "Just our luck." Chen shook her head. "Actually, perhaps not. We have been held by the ghosts for 1,000 years, but we soon suspected the ghosts have been here longer still, a long time. You can see the evidence on the airless worlds better. The moons of Guba Sea itself, for instance. Structures, visible through the telescopes we had then. But now, you see, we are here. A species the ghosts are unfamiliar with and cannot, I think, understand. Because from the ghosts' point of view, we suddenly exploded out of a system which the Chile had visited. And you have the anomaly of the wormhole ghost, with its bad news for its own kind. Perhaps the ghosts have accelerated their project as a result." Jophiel tried to think that through. "Susan, what project? Are you suggesting that the ghosts have got something to do with the Nova event?" But before she could reply, the flitter dipped, banked, lurched. Jophiel glanced out of his window at the fleeing ground. On the floor of the great valley, a river meandered, itself a mighty torrent, but obviously not the creator of this huge geological wound. And there, just ahead, a kind of pale, milky glow, a colour Jophiel recognised after his experiences in the solar system, even in this cloud-choked world's murky light. "That's Chile hull plate," Nicola said.
"Indeed,"
Susan said softly. They fell silent. The flitter ducked and swooped, beyond any human control, and soon pale artifice, complex and crusted and covering the ground, swept under the prow. As the flitter descended, Jophiel made out what might have been a cityscape, a scatter of blocks, of pyramids and cubes, pillars and towers. But there was a randomness to it all that made the plain look as if it was covered by huge salt crystals, perhaps, eroding from some seam. Still, the flitter dropped until it touched gently down. Unreal as he was, Jophiel climbed cautiously down the flitter's steps to the planet's surface. Hard, warm rock underfoot. The air was warm too, thick, murky, thicker than any fog, and it resisted his motions as he tried to push through it. It was like wading across an ocean floor. Susan Chen stood patiently as Jophiel Nicola and Harris Kemp, laden with his virtual generating backpack, took slow, exploratory steps. She said,
"Some people feel claustrophobic in this air, as if they're drowning."
"Well, she hadn't said that," Harris said. Nicola pointed to shadows, what looked like a cluster of buildings in the murk. "I take it that's our target."
"Indeed."
Susan took cautious steps in that direction, leaning on her stick. Jophiel and Nicola walked side by side. Harris followed Susan, walking as slowly as she did. He muttered observations into a voice recorder, one of the few technological gadgets the ghosts had allowed on this trip, aside from the skin suits and Jophiel's projector box riding on Harris's back.
"We have plenty of time," Susan said. "It is near local noon. The day length of this planet is only a little more than Earth's. It is best if we stay together, however. The ghosts find it less alarming if we don't scatter. Come along." "I wouldn't bother making a map, by the way, or if you do, don't take it too seriously."
Jophiel wondered what she meant by that. They were already nearing the buildings, Jophiel saw. Blocky, geometric shapes, mostly cuboid, some spheres, pyramids, even a spindly tetrahedron. None much taller than a couple of stories in human terms, looming out of the turbid air.
"We will find my crewmates soon. They never go far. Follow me. Keep your eyes open, especially look for technology, portable artifacts. That's what the ghosts want."
Nicola snorted. "Now you sound like my mother. She would always set me a test every time we went for a walk." Jophiel thought he heard Susan sigh. It was such a soft sound, he wasn't sure.
"I suppose I have been a mother for 1,000 years. One gets into habits of speech."
They came to the buildings. They followed a narrow street, between the blank faces of two relatively small structures, each maybe 3 meters tall. No, not blank. Jophiel saw their walls were marked with pale pink crosses, roughly daubed. Jophiel could see no doorway, no windows, no sign of what these box-like buildings might have been erected for. Only these empty, pale walls. And when he looked down at his feet, he saw he was still walking on basaltic ground. There was no road surface. It was as if the buildings had been set down on the bare rock like a giant's toys. Toys made of chelly hull plate. They came out of the alley at an intersection. More buildings all around them, set not quite in regular rows, so that the roads and alleys between them were offset and followed odd angles, some widened, some narrowed. A little further ahead, Jophiel saw, was a group of much taller buildings, still essentially box-like, cuboids and pyramids and spheres. The central cluster cast long shadows over the other buildings. It looked like a downtown in a city of the American Anthropocene, he thought, like New York, perhaps.
"No markings," Nicola said.
"What?"
"Wake up, Poole. Markings. None on this building, see?"
She pointed to a small, slim monolith between two towering pyramids.
"But look what Susan is doing."
She pointed again. Susan had stopped by another small building between two giants.
"This is the one we just cleared, I think."
She took off her pack, drew out what looked like an ancient can of paint, slipped her gloved hand into the pot, and crudely scrawled a cross on that virginal surface. Then she moved on. Harris went over to inspect. He touched the pale, sticky liquid.
"Interesting stuff. Paint that sticks to a chelly hull material."
paint. That's hardly the priority, Nicola said testily. Why is she doing this? How long has this been going on?
She looked around with a fresh eye.
What is this place? What's it for? How does it work?
You'll see. This way. Susan Chen smiled and beckoned, pack on her back, leaning on her stick, the paint pot in her free gloved hand. She led them down another skewed alley and brought them to a door in the wall of the building she had marked. It was just another box, distinguished only by the fact that it had a doorway, a rectangular space open with no cover. Inside there were no fittings that Jophiel could see, nothing save for a pair of low pillars, one at either end of the single big room, that looked as if they had grown out of the floor. The pillars appeared to be made of chili hull plate like the rest of the room. The interior looked like it spanned half the width of the building. There was evidently a partition with a further door. Jophiel thought he could hear faint voices coming through the door. The space glowed with a soft internal light. The four of them staring at this geometric perfection looked grubby, clumsy, unfinished. Susan smiled at them.
Don't worry about dusty footmarks. The place seems to self-clean, they all do.
Harris walked over to one pillar. It was about waist height.
Why are we here?
I mean, why do the ghosts send you here? Susan waved a hand.
You understand. This is a Chile station of some kind. All of this is Chile construction material, as the ghosts call it. I understand you call it hull plate or membrane, depending on the grade. A replicating material that grows in sunlight. There are no Chile here. All this is automated somehow. And what we're looking for is Chile artifacts.
Artifacts.
The whole of this city is a Chile artifact, of course. We seek small, portable devices. I've only ever seen two kinds. Two in 1,000 years.
She passed one pillar.
One type is associated with pillars like these. You always find them in such rooms, sitting on pillars facing each other. Hoops. Each may be half a meter across. Sky blue, polished, paper thin. And before they're detached from the pillars, you can see pink sparks dashing around the circumference. They go inert when removed, as they have been from this place, as you can see. The ghosts think they are some kind of comms device. My own best guess is that this particular kind of installation is a monitoring station.
She cast a shy glance at Jophiel.
I did follow your adventures when I was young, she said. When you chased the Chile into the heart of the sun. You thought it was studying creatures of dark matter there. Maybe that's what this station is for. An observation post for the Chile to monitor an anomalous star. With some kind of comm system, the hoops perhaps. Well, if the ghosts ever made this work or figured out its principles, they haven't told me about it.
Jophiel thought it over. So, the ghosts came to this system, you think, knowing this Chile station was in place but abandoned, or left uninhabited anyhow.
The ghosts want the stuff, Nicola said.
Chile treasure. Like Saxons in Britain, looting a deserted Roman town. But now they've been disturbed. They've detected Chile activity relatively nearby. I mean, in our solar system. As soon as there's a hint that the legions are returning, the Saxons are looking over their shoulder.
Susan smiled at the analogy. It is a very long time since I thought about Saxons and Romans. We must talk.
I'd like that.
And the other kind of artifact? Harris asked. A flower, we call it, a Chile flower.
A core from which hull plate will grow. You'll recognize it when you see it.
Ah, Jophiel said now. We hypothesized the existence of such things. We never found one back in the solar system. We called them seeds.
Susan gently tapped one wall with a flat, gloved hand. Growth is the key. So I have learned in time. Though meaningful observation takes decades. Like watching a forest grow. Yes, exactly like that. Can you guess how this place works yet? It's not like a town, a human-built environment. However, it fulfills whatever function it has. It's more like a community of living things.
Jophiel, for once, was at least one step behind. He was still distracted by those apparent voices from beyond the doorway, muffled in the heavy, almost liquid air. Living.
Susan smiled again. Jophiel had the strong impression that she was enjoying this, enjoying having an audience, as well she might.
You'll have to take my word for it. Over time, by which I mean years, decades, these buildings change. They grow, and sometimes they move. They will detach from the surface and...
Harris broke in, excited. I think I know what she means. This building grows, literally. It is nothing but hull plate, so... Maybe it starts from a seed of hull plate, Susan's flower, and grows, converting starlight energy to mass, to this planar material. And the more it grows, the more light it soaks up, and it grows some more. It's an exponential process. We have good mathematical models. Just as we saw with the cache in the solar system, so with this building. It must be growing into some pre-programmed form, presumably reaching some maximum size.
Or... It would, if not for the presence of other buildings around it, Susan said, which you see block its light and therefore its growth.
And Jophiel thought of the long shadows cast by the downtown he had seen.
It's like a forest, then, he said. These buildings aren't planned.
They just grow where they can, competing for ground space and light.
Yes. Just like a forest which is dominated by big, tall trees and smaller growth stunted in the shade.
Even the timing is persuasive, Harris mused. At the orbit of Earth, the doubling time of Chile hull plate was 10 or 15 years. The sunlight is less here, but...
The building would grow at the rate of a tree over decades.
Well done, Susan said, nodding. You got it quickly. But as I said, the forest of buildings changes, sometimes day to day. Not just the size of the buildings, but their locations. They aren't rooted to the ground, you see. That's why we got into the habit of marking the buildings. The ghosts supplied us with a kind of adhesive paint so we can label those we have searched. We don't know the full life cycle, and if the ghosts know, they don't tell us. Perhaps older buildings collapse or drift into space.
Or are consumed by their competitors, Nicola said with a certain relish. Like strangler figs.
All this is plausible, isn't it? A hull plate ecology.
One thing we learned about the Chile back in the solar system is that everything about the Chile is like a merger of life and technology.
Again, those voices, softly bickering. It sounded like. Jophiel asked, Susan, who else is in here?
My crewmates, of course.
She looked oddly embarrassed, though the expression on her ancient, immobile face was hard to read.
If you are ready, you should be prepared.
Nicola took her gloved hand.
Just show us.
Without another word, Susan led them out of the further door, across a short, narrowing alley, and into a building on the far side. Jophiel followed with dread. He found himself in a near twin of the building he'd just left, another hull plate box, no comms pillars. And here, in the middle of the floor, was a group of people, sitting, hunched over. There were perhaps a dozen of them,
They sat in a circle facing each other, muttering. Jophiel thought he heard 3-4 voices speaking at once. The words were incomprehensible, if there were any words in that stream of babbled syllables. Susan, still holding Nicola's hand, said, "Don't be alarmed." As she spoke, her crewmates' heads turned and they fell silent, wary in the presence of strangers, watchful. A dozen, Jophiel counted quickly. All adults, apparently wearing antique, much-patched skin suits. One even had a faded Pool Industries logo on the back. They had been sharing food from rough packets strewn on the floor between them. One lifted his faceplate to take a mouthful of food, a snorting, gobbling sound. They all seemed short, bent over, squat. Jophiel realized he couldn't distinguish male from female, could tell nothing about their ages. A moment of stillness. The two groups faced each other. It was like a pack of apes, Jophiel thought wildly. Apes facing 3 angels, himself and his crewmates standing straight and tall in their gleaming skin suits, angels from the stars. Susan walked over to the group. She knelt among them, put her arms over their shoulders. She seemed to lead them in a kind of chant. "The rules of 3, remember? 3 minutes without air, 3 hours in the cold, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. Say it with me. 3 minutes without air, 3 hours in the cold." Then, without warning, the apes stood. Still hunched over, they hastily grabbed at their food packs and shambled untidily out of a far door. Jophiel had only a blurred impression of them. He thought he saw stunted limbs, bent backs. One of them came close to knuckle-walking like a chimp, and some of them had 2 small heads, the skulls deformed. None of them had looked the newcomers in the face. When they were gone, Susan walked unsteadily to the centre of the floor where the group had been sitting. Stood amid scraps of food debris, an abandoned rucksack. "I'm sorry. That didn't go well. I didn't know how to... I wanted you to see for yourself." She sighed heavily. "So now you know. Now you know." She trembled, folded. Nicola hurried forward, took her stick, and embraced the woman. "Come, sit down with me." Chapter 18. Nicola had lightweight fold-out chairs in her pack. She set these out in a circle, where the gourd crew had been. Harris had coffee. Jophiel accepted a virtual cup, finding it a relief to sit and escape the clutch of gravity. Harris didn't sit down himself. "One of us ought to do the job we were sent down for. I'll go explore, see if I can find some Chile treasure." He picked up his pack and pushed out of the building. And, in this quasi-living Chile structure, Susan Chen said she would tell Jophiel and Nicola her story.
"The ghosts hear all we say, probably. But at least here we have the illusion of privacy."
Jophiel said, "On our ships we had a tradition called the testimony. Every time the crew gathered, one of us would get up to tell their story. How the Chile attack affected them, their family, their life. Susan, give us your testimony." She smiled.
"Thank you, Jophiel. Very well. You know I was born just a few years after you, or your template. It seems such a remote age now. I took my assessments for federal service. I was recommended for the police. Something about my qualities of determination, of general intelligence rather than a specialized intellect, attracted the recruiters. A certain puzzle-solving ability.
Actually, I always wanted to follow you pools out to the frontier, one way or another. The outer planets. I always thought there would be room for me out there one day. Out where people like you were building things. I could deal with crimes among the settlers, resolve complex legal disputes when you tried to extend the wormhole network to Neptune and found some crusty old settler in your way. Jophiel nodded gravely. I think you'd have been a good fit. She seemed unreasonably pleased at that. She beamed, her face made briefly young by the smile. But then the Chili came. I was 20 years old. I saw the images of the wormhole ghost. I remembered that when much later I encountered the ghosts who captured us. They have us call them ghosts, you know. I think in response to their monitoring of that event, the labels you used. I had to stay in the police, of course, in the aftermath of the incursion. As people grew afraid, there was a great deal of civil disorder. I was, 24 years old when the displacement happened. On cold earth, I helped keep order during the refugee flows, the resettlement of mankind. Then I was co-opted onto the policing of the scattership building program until I was assigned to a ship myself.
Jophiel said, The Gourd?
It was a green ship. I was second officer, an essentially administrative function. The work suited me. I'd had a complicated life, never had children of my own, never the time, as for many of my generation. I think on some level I loved the idea of nurturing an ecohab, a scrap of Earth life all the way to the stars. For 3 subjective years the mission went well. We were only some 10 light-years from Earth.
Jophiel prompted, And then?
The ghosts found us.
Harris walked in.
Sorry to interrupt. Look what I found.
He opened his gloved hand. On its palm rested an artifact as pale as hull plate, a small cylindrical base from which sprouted 6 angular petals.
I've tried to keep it in the shadow. Don't want the thing growing out of control.
Susan smiled.
There is an on switch. Don't worry.
Nicola whistled.
So that, she said in awe, is a Chili flower. You did well to find it on your first expedition down here, Susan said.
I cheated. Harris sat on one of the fold-out chairs. Any of that coffee left?
I just followed your crew, Susan. They left a kind of trail, mostly of food packets, and this in a kind of little cache they built.
Susan sounded proud.
They are good people, good crew, just so disadvantaged. There's been nothing more I could do.
Nicola said, her voice cold,
Tell us about the ghosts, what they did when they captured you.
Susan seemed to sit up straighter, Jophiel observed, a police officer making a report after 1,000 years.
As I said, it was 3 years into the mission. You know that they had tracked the eruption of the wormhole ghost that came for you, Jophiel, or your template. And they came looking for us, you see. They took us. I don't know if they took other scatterships, what else they may have done in the solar system itself. They detached the life dome from our gut drive system, enfolded the dome into what you have called a tangle ship, and brought us here. The hyperdrive journey took 8 months. At the time, the crew, the surviving crew, made careful observations. I still have records.
Jophiel nodded.
Good. The more you can tell us, the more we can learn about the technology.
I hope I would have done as well. Nicola said gently,
So, they brought you here, Set your life dome down on Goober Sea, just as you saw it.
Geoffrey asked, and the crew? Put to work?
You mean down here, foraging for Chile artifacts? No. That came later, when they discovered how effective we were at the task. Just the right size with the right foraging skills, you see. Skills honed by a million years of evolution on the African savannah. Now put to work for an alien species.
She smiled.
We'd complain about that. Make each other laugh.
Then what?
Well, at first they tested us. Once they learned our language, they interrogated us together and singly, tried to find out all about us. Not just our technology and other capabilities, but about our evolutionary history, our biology, our culture. They liked to watch us work. They observed us working on the life dome systems, took us out on the planet for various exercises, traps to fall into or escape from. As Discovery-era scientists used animals in testing, so they used us. People were hurt, of course.
Killed, Nicola snapped.
Not purposefully. They did have a crude way of analysing us, you see, as if we were unfamiliar machinery, not living beings. Even testing us to destruction. Looking for the spirit by taking the body apart. Yes, there were casualties. The corpses were taken away for dissection, I suppose. Soon many of the living were taken away, abducted, with samples of technologies and life, soil and grass and trees from the life dome. The animals, chickens and rabbits, even rats. We never saw our crewmates again. You understand, we were a large crew, tens of thousands, many in sleep pods during the voyage.
All the scatterships had huge complements, Jophiel said. Even green ships like yours. The sea ships even more.
Yes. Well, now the crew was broken up. In squads of 1,000 or more, families were split apart and so on. After the first few rounds of this, we tried to make the ghosts understand what they were doing to us. Well, I don't know what became of those taken away. I was not one of those taken.
Jophiel noticed how Nicola's face hardened. He thought now that she had been growing steadily more angry ever since they had met the gourd crew. Susan went on,
"But those left here, no more than a few hundred, they wanted to keep us alive. Indeed, it was clear that they intended us to breed in captivity. Animals in a zoo."
A very archaic word, Jophiel thought.
One of our biologists said that he thought they had initially been baffled by our body structure. The way we are, to some extent, composite creatures as they are, with our microbiome of bacteria and so forth, but much more integrated as a whole than they are. We were unfamiliar forms to them. They were fascinated by us, or at least by the fact that the Chile had taken such an interest in us, when we were doing no more than rattle around in our own solar system. Why should that be so? And they were intrigued or alarmed by the fact that one of their own, maybe from some other reality strand, had come back to warn us, as it did. Particularly by the fact that the wormhole ghost seemed to come from a defeated society of ghosts in the future, that it seemed to worship you or your template, Jophiel.
She actually grinned.
They just hated that.
Good, Nicola snarled.
And in turn, we watched them. We learned about them. A lot more than they think we know.
Jophiel listened, intent, to her analysis. The world of the ghosts, Chen believed, had once been Earth-like.
Blue skies, a yellow sun. And perhaps the ghosts had once been more human-like, more terrestrial in their body plans. But as the ghosts climbed to awareness, their sun evaporated, killed by energy blasts from a companion pulsar. When the atmosphere started snowing out, the ghosts rebuilt themselves. They turned themselves into compact, silvered spheres, each body barely begrudging an erg to the cold outside. They gathered other life forms in with them, vegetable and animal, or whatever equivalent domains had existed on their world, each ghost a kind of ecology in itself, an autarky, as Harris had said. That epochal ordeal left the ghosts determined, secretive, often reckless, Susan had deduced, dangerous, vengeful in an abstract sense. They moved out into space, which they called the heat sink, to fulfill grand ambitions. They would rebuild the universe itself, if necessary, to prevent another extinction threat, another betrayal. They never forgot their origins. In all their communities, you'll see a tower, a beacon on the top. A destroyer tower, they call it. A commemoration of the pulsar, the star god that killed their world. They worship that which destroyed them. Nicola nodded. Now they seek other destroyer gods, and they found us, she said darkly. Jophiel said gently, but while all this was going on, time was passing. We knew we were far from home. We could tell that much by basic astronomy sightings, and we knew there was no help coming for us. I used to tell the other stories about you, about Michael Poole, your exploits, how you fought the Chile, how you'd come for us one day. Here I am. She smiled enigmatically. You were always here. For me, anyhow. I told the others. They never believed me. I could never prove it. And then she said, reality leaks. Jophiel tried not to react. Nicola and Harris looked baffled by the remark. We could only wait for rescue, Susan went on. We had no means of escape. And we didn't know what might have happened to the rest of humanity, you see. Those scatterships seemed terribly vulnerable in retrospect. What if some force had just shot them out of the sky as we ourselves had been overwhelmed? We decided we had a duty to survive. We might be the last people left anywhere. So we imagined and feared. We would have children, raise them in this place. That was a conscious decision. We would allow ourselves to be bred like zoo animals, so that if only through us, mankind would live on. We scrambled to assure our survival. We took inventories of what we had, supplies of all sorts, clothing, food, medical. We needed a means to keep our life support systems going for decades, even centuries, we were thinking, even then. For generations. But the ghosts themselves helped us. They wanted to keep us alive for their own purposes. They have the equivalent of matter printers, better than ours, which they used to produce the food we needed and other essentials. And so we survived and bred in captivity. We gave the first of the children names that reflected aspects of Earth. My own first daughter was called Sky Blue. She smiled. Sky was a good girl. But there were so few of us, even then. We knew we would have to plan to try to maintain genetic diversity. I was one of the leaders. I felt I should show the way. So it began. My second child, a decade later, was with another man. We tried to build this into the culture for the future. We divided ourselves up into clans with complicated intermarriage rules.
All this watched over by the ghosts, Nicola said.
Yes, she said darkly. But we tried to keep one secret from them. Even as we watched them watching us. AS technology, anti-senescence. It was the one necessity we didn't tell the ghosts about or ask them to replicate. We were determined, you see, that some of us should survive, the original crew, to be witnesses to what had happened to us, to guide future generations. We kept this hidden, in plain sight. The ghosts knew nothing of our breeding cycles, after all. Perhaps it seemed natural to them that some percentage of a group of humans should live while the rest die off. Ghosts do not die, by the way. Well, you could burn one down, but barring accidents, they are immortal. They are creatures of quasi-independent components. Even their skins are independent creatures. They flap in their tanks like huge rays. Components die, ghosts do not. We hoped they would not understand our life cycles because of that. So, we drew lots. At first, 10 of us would take the drug. 10 to outlive the others. I was one of the 10. I lived on as the generations started to tick by. Well, even from the beginning, our carefully planned breeding scheme showed strains. We were just too few, too few. The first deleterious symptoms showed up in the 4th generation. Ironically, reduced fertility was one of the earliest crises. And our AS supplies were diminishing. We decided that the 10 should reduce to 5. Again, we drew lots. And then later, 5 to 2. We did not draw lots this time. We debated who should live and who should die. Then we voted on it. I was one of the 2. It was a bad choice. After only a few years, I had lost my companion. He died of a genetic condition exposed by centuries of AS treatments. Centuries, yes, it was already that. Still, I lived on. I had no choice. I retained a certain authority over the rest. The passing generations. With time, I reworked the AS medication. I adjusted the genetic legacy of the crewmates, their DNA. They would not live on themselves, but their blood would contain the medicine that would save me. They give me transfusions, they are used to it. But for the crew, there were cumulative effects, a slow degradation. Perhaps all that we originators had gone through, the displacement, the cold earth, the scattership flight, had damaged us more than we knew. And of course we laboured under the burden of this world's gravity, which stressed hearts, bones, muscles. There were spontaneous abortions, infant deaths, a rise in the incidence of diabetes, heart disease, a reduction of intellectual capacity, that was the most distressing to see. And schizophrenia, other disorders. The damaged gave birth to the damaged. The ghosts watched us. They were smart, manipulative. They watched us struggle physically and spiritually. They used us as scavengers in this hazardous place, as you see, and more died. Yet we survived.
Yes. You survived.
Jophiel stood, turned, nearly stumbling. A ghost hovered in the hull plate room, filling the space.
Still, we study you, and still, you baffle us.
Nicola walked up to it. Her face was twisted with fury, Jophiel saw, alarmed, and she had the chili flower in her hand. Boldly with her free hand, she poked the ghost in the equator of its spinning bulk. You're not a projection.
She laughed, disrespectful.
How did you get through the door?
We have modes of transport which are beyond...
Do you always snoop like this?
Nicola moved closer to its heavy bulk.
Do you have no respect, no pity, after 1,000 years?
What is 1,000 years to us?
Today I learnt that you ghosts worship that which destroys you.
She pointed at Jophiel.
Worship him, then.
The ghost paused as if considering. Then it said, Yes, you, the pool. In another reality, it seems, you humans would crush us. Drive us to near extinction, subjugate us to the extent that we would worship you. Well, here humanity is scattered and helpless. If you think what we have done here is cruel, it was not intentional. Perhaps on this world at least we have already extracted 40 generations worth of revenge for your epochal crimes.
And Nicola smiled coldly. Revenge?
Jophiel had flown warships with Nicola from the surface of the moon. He knew that expression.
Nicola, no! This is revenge!
She plunged the flower's hull plate blades, sharper than any knife, into the belly equator of the ghost. The huge sphere, weighing a ton mass, shuddered and rolled. Nicola, clinging with both hands to the cylindrical base of the chili flower, was thrown off her feet and slammed against the hull plate wall. But she braced with both feet against the wall and held her position. The ghost rolled desperately, but succeeded only in dragging its own silver flesh past the blade, and as Nicola held her weapon steady, a deep slice was ripped through that fine carapace. The flesh separated around the gash, and something like blood spilled out, viscous and hot, and then what looked like organs, lumpy ropes tumbling from the wound. Nicola screamed defiance.
There he is! There is Michael Poole! Worship him, you destroyer god! Worship him!
Harris raced towards the fight. Whether to help Nicola or to drag her away, Jophiel wasn't sure. But then, more ghosts appeared in the room. Simply appeared. They were not there, then they were there, hanging in the air like grotesque chandeliers. One of them slammed into Harris's back, knocking him down. Two others headed for Nicola. And another swept over Jophiel's virtual form, engulfing him in darkness. Harris, Jophiel, and Susan were taken back to the island life dome. Nicola was not returned. It would be 3 months before a ghost spoke to any of them again. Chapter 19. It happened at the beginning of the ship's day. The changeover of watches was going through as smoothly as usual. In the amphitheatre at the heart of the life dome, the small band of Gord descendants were beginning the cycle of their own day too, of therapy, medical checks, gentle conversations with the island folk, all under the supervision of Harris Kemp and the ship's other medical seniors. The Gord folk kept wandering off, however. Weeks after they had been brought into the life dome, they still seemed fascinated by the grass and flowers and trees, though the dome's parkland was not as it had been. The ghosts had taken, with Jophiel's reluctant acquiescence, swathes of grassland, samples of chickens, even rats, just as they had once raided the Gord. The beginning of the day, the handover from the night watch to the first day watch. That was when the ghost appeared in the air, in the officer suite under the apex of the island's life dome. Jophiel, Asher, Harris hurried up to the office to meet it. When they got there, Jophiel glared at the ghost. Where is Nicola Emery? No answer. Are you the one who called itself the Ambassador?
The question has no real meaning.
Nor does your answer, Jophiel growled.
Harris murmured to Jophiel,
"It's probably telling the truth. Ghosts are composite creatures. Surely you could replace its hide, for instance, without changing its sense of self significantly. Their identities may be impermanent, even shareable. If Nicola were here, she'd probably quote the ship of Theseus at us."
The ghost observed, "You have no crew member named Theseus?" A stiff silence. Harris stepped forward.
"I'm in charge of medicine among the crew here. I want to thank you for allowing us to bring the Gord crew into this life dome so that we could care for them."
"Our intention is not harm," the ghost said blandly. "It has never been harm. We are here today to invite you to witness our stellar destabilization project."
Jophiel frowned. "What is the stellar destabilization project? Why should we care about it?"
"Come with me, Jophiel Poole. You will learn. Your reaction will be interesting. Choose a companion."
"I choose Nicola Emery."
A silent standoff that stretched for long seconds. Asher whispered,
"You must go, of course. We need to learn everything we can." She said to the ghost, "I will come."
"Be ready in 1 hour." The ghost vanished.
Jophiel issued a rattle of the usual orders to Harris, in command pro tem. In particular, Jophiel made sure a covert watch was always kept up on the wormhole interface, their only source of salvation. If Michael Poole had received the desperate plea for help Jophiel had sent through the wormhole to the Couchy, he hadn't answered yet. But then such was the ferocious time dilation suffered now by the Couchy. Only hours had passed for Michael Poole since the abduction, while 4 months had passed for Jophiel. Help could come at any time, but only if it didn't occur to the ghosts to break up the wormhole interface. Then Jophiel turned his attention to this new experience, or perhaps opportunity. Their transport was the usual kind, a relic flitter hull stripped of human propulsion capabilities and wedged inside a ghost tangle ship. Once aboard, Jophiel and Asher stood before a viewscreen, watching Guba Sea recede. They were told they were being taken to some kind of station, closer to the star than Mercury was to the sun. A journey of around 2 astronomical units then, twice the distance between Earth and Sun as it had been. It would have taken a top-of-the-range gut ship like the Island several days to span such a journey at 1 gravity thrust, but the ghost hyperdrive took no time at all. Suddenly the face of the star loomed before them, a sea of curdled light. Jophiel flinched. Asher was captivated. Sunspots like whirlpools, the marks of flaws in the magnetic field. Towards one edge of the stellar disk, Jophiel saw, a tremendous flare was gathering, arches of plasma torn from the star's upper layer and shaped by magnetic flux into fist-like coils. Asher held a soft screen up to the window, busily gathering data. "Look at it. You and Nicola saw our sun up close. It was nothing like this. You can see how this star is destabilized. These huge, incipient flares."
A tremendous tangle ship drifted across the face of the star, a silhouette of rope within which silver droplets gleamed.
Jophiel checked screens of his own. "That tangle ship itself is the size of a small moon. It's an observation station, maybe? Hovering a few 1,000 kilometers above the photosphere. Remember our own station. Pathetic little Larunda. A space wheel hiding in the shadow of Mercury as near as we dared go."
"Hey, you got the job done."
"In the meantime, what are those?" He pointed,
As the ghost ship or station passed across their field of view, it was releasing artifacts. A chain of silvered spheres, like the morphology of the ghosts themselves, but much larger, each perhaps 100 meters across. As soon as each sphere was dropped, it joined a rapid, coordinated descent towards the surface of the star. Asher studied her readouts. These are massive. A lot of heavy equipment in there. She glanced at Jophiel, uncertain. Probes? Maybe. They look too big for that. He hesitated. To me, that looks like a bombing run. Asher frowned. Maybe. Let's review what we know. This star is unstable. You generally get a nova explosion when a star has a companion, and the lesser star, distorted by tides, sheds a mass of material onto the surface of the larger. This builds up until you get to some critical fraction, usually about 1/10,000th of the Tars star's mass, and... blam. Jophiel grinned. Blam. She shrugged. That surface junk layer starts to fuse. In a normal star, all the fusion goes on in the very centre, out of sight. Been there, seen that, Nicola and me. But if it's at the surface, a nova, the star's luminosity can increase by 10,000, 100,000 times, and it can last for weeks, until that unwelcome surface layer is disrupted. Then the process starts all over again with the drizzle of more matter from the companion. But here there is no companion star, just the ghosts and their depth charges. Are the ghosts causing this? Deliberately perturbing this star? If so, why? I'm just guessing until we get more data. Well... that might be soon. He pointed at the scenery. That big tangle ship still dominated the viewscreen, but now a part of that tangle had cleared, revealing a kind of tunnel into a complex interior, a tunnel whose mouth drew closer. We're being pulled in. Maybe we'll be transferred from our carrier to that... station.
This isn't so much a docking, Asher said, queasy. It feels like we're being ingested, doesn't it? Like it's biological. Ugh! Why can't they just have hatches and airlocks like normal people?
Jophiel tried to focus. We may be exiting the flitter soon. Check your skin suit and life support. Make sure you have your soft screens and any other equipment you need. My virtual projection unit, too. Jophiel began to close down those aspects of the flitter under human control, essentially the life support. And he tried to send a progress report back to his crew. This wasn't the first excursion that had been allowed beyond the island life dome. Sometimes such messages got through, sometimes not. Meanwhile, slowly, smoothly, without any sharp acceleration, the relic flitter was drawn into the ship's knotted complexity. The face of the star was soon blocked from Jophiel's view, but the splinters of its light that got through were sharp, dazzling. And here and there Jophiel saw movement in the tangle, ghosts sliding through the ropey structure of their ship, looking like droplets of mercury on a wire, chains of them moving between one embedded structure and another. Gradually he made out a mass ahead, smaller than most ghost structures. A rough cylinder with a kind of spherical extrusion at the back. It was another flitter, he recognised, presumably another relic of the Gord, taken in here and caught up in the cabling. A place where humans could live inside this starbound tangle ship. But Susan Chen had never mentioned humans having been taken into a stargazing station like this before. So who was already here? Their own flitter nudged to a gentle, conventional docking with this deep-embedded facility.
Jophiel supposed he was about to find out. A shudder as hatches opened, a soft hiss as pressure equalized. The two of them released